do not. Are we just doing public?
Yeah, just doing public hearing.
Good afternoon. I'd like to bring to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency on this beautiful Thursday, February 6, 2014. Today we have four bills on the agenda. House Bill 4140 will be carried over. And we will be going just a touch out of order. We're going to start with 4135. And then 4122, and then 4132 last. So with that, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 4135. Jen, could you give us just a brief description, please?
I will. This requires the CIO, that's the Chief Information Officer, to appoint a strategic technology team, and it requires that team to work collaboratively with the CIO's staff and with the executive staff of state agencies that are responsible for information technology resources. Declares an emergency effective on passage. Draw your attention to the proposed Dash 1 amendment. This amendment was offered up at the request of Microsoft. Directs the CIO to formulate rules, policies, and standards that are prohibiting persons who provide information technology services to state agencies from using the data obtained in the course of providing services to a state agency if certain conditions, and there's three of them. It creates a user profile or an online advertising based on the user's characteristic and behavior, or if it's to sell for commercial gain, or if it's to engage in activities that weaken, reduce, or compromise the privacy interests of the state.
Thank you. And I believe we'll probably, if Mr. Gardner is okay, we'll go with the agencies first on this. So I'd like to call up Michael Jordan and Alex Pettit and Pat Allen. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Jordan. I'm the state's chief operating officer and the director at the Department of Administrative Services, and I'll allow my friends to introduce themselves as they speak. We're here today to obviously support the House Bill 4135. My job, if I may, Mr. Chair, is to give a bit of context of how we got to this place in this bill. It has a history from last session that I'd like to at least give the members some context about what we're up to. So actually 2 years ago, we went into a bit of a study piece of work for all agencies regarding our internal services. That was IT, HR, budget and finance, and procurement. We employed a group called the Hackett Group and did what I believe is the first deep dive into internal service data and how we do our business internally that the state's ever done. Produced a huge amount of data and some recommendations. And from that work, the group, one of the recommendations regarding IT was that we needed to get our arms around our governance structure, how we actually make decisions regarding information technology. Along with that, in the last session, we worked with Representative Harker and Representative Vega Peterson on a number of bills. One of them was House Bill 3258, which put the chief information officer's position in statute and described its powers and responsibilities. There was also a budget note in working with Representative Vega Peterson regarding how we support and guide small agencies in state government regarding information technology. In response to both of those things, one, we hired a new chief information officer, and Mr. Pettit will have a chance to speak with you in just a moment. But we also engaged in a process with agencies through the enterprise leadership team to develop a new IT governance structure. And that structure is now fully designed and ready to implement. And one of the component parts of implementation of that new governance structure is the formation of these strategic technology offices. We are mapping all of our agencies into groups around the particular policy area that they work under, so natural resources, economy, jobs, et cetera, et cetera. And we will have one of these technology offices that report directly to the state CIO in each of those clusters of agencies to help, one, support and guide and provide advice to small agencies within those clusters so that they have some technology support regarding their particular applications that they may be trying to develop. Secondly, to recognize within those clusters of agencies when a business process issue cuts across more than one agency, and when can we pull that discussion up to a shared service model among agencies so that we're more efficient and effective, and also reduce the proliferation of applications that we tend to chase. We are, for your information, about 1,000 applications more than our peer state would be, a comparable state. We have around 2,800 to 2,900 applications. That's about 1,000 more than our peer states, and what Hackett Group would consider just about double what a world-class agency of our size would have. What that does, of course, is require us to have a significant amount more human resource to chase those applications, support them, keep them running for the different agencies. So another job of these technology officers would be to analyze the need for the technology solution. Also, we are giving those offices some what we would call business analyst support. Often, and the state is not unique in this, often we tend to grab a technology solution for what we perceive to be a problem in our business, and in fact, the problem is the business process, not necessarily the technology. And so I'm fond of saying we often put Chanel No. 5 on a pig. We put a really good technology solution on a really bad business process. And so another job for these technology officers with some business analyst support will be to take the agency's problem and really analyze what's the business problem that we're trying to fix before we apply a technology solution to it. The last thing that we're hoping that these officers will do is not, as when they can recognize a shared service opportunity that we would do a shared service among multiple business practices to solve a common problem, but also if in fact the issue is enterprise-wide and we could leverage an enterprise solution to it to elevate that to the enterprise leadership team to have a discussion about whether we can be more efficient in trying to do something enterprise-wide. Also, through these offices in conjunction with the state CIO's office, the other thing we want to do is begin to provide a lot more rigor around the project management when we do decide to go ahead and do a project, particularly, however, with small and medium-sized agencies that don't have a lot of IT support within their agency to manage an IT project and have it come to fruition. So, that's kind of a rough construct of what the bill does and what we intend to do with those positions. Lastly, logistically speaking, we intend to run three of these offices as a pilot this biennium so that we can see how they run, work the kinks out. As I said, we've just gotten done with the IT governance architecture. Now we have to actually make it work. And so we're providing these positions in this biennium to run the pilot, and our intention is to fully fund it going into the next biennium. We'd incorporate that in our budget proposals. We intend to staff these internally by moving positions either from agencies or recrafting positions that are currently in the CIO's office. So there isn't a budget ask for us to do the pilots this biennium, and we'll be incorporating the full funding of this approach into the 15-17 budget. So pragmatically, that's how we intend to get up and running. With that, I will stop talking, and if there are questions now, I'm happy to answer them, but I'd pass it along to Alex Pettit.
I think perhaps we'll get a full spectrum of, testimony, and then we'll open it up for questions. So, welcome, and if you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Alex Pettit. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the state of Oregon. I've been in this position now for a little over a month, so just now figuring my way a little bit around some of these things. although I am new to the post here, the setup that that's been constructed here in Oregon is similar to what we did in Oklahoma, in that we called them business segment directors. So we identified or articulated around our cabinet secretaries, there were basically seven functions that we did: revenue collection, entitlement and insurance, and health, public safety. Health was actually a separate group. Public safety. We did education. We did all the licensing and back office type activities that you would expect, construction and natural resources. So those were our clusters or our groups. And for each one of them, they had a business segment director who was responsible for ensuring not only that there were, when an initiative was identified something brought forward, if it was applicable to everyone or the entire group of agencies in their group, but also that those that were brought forward were compatible with their sister agencies, because very often in law enforcement, in natural resources, in any of those, there are a lot of things where those solutions need to be complementary. So that was really their task, and the charge here is very, very similar. The bill does a couple of other things. It aligns references to various strategic plans to one information resource management strategy so that the state will have a single unified plan for IT. It directs me to minimize the duplicative or redundant advisory boards. And again, I haven't worked through all the governance chart yet, so I don't know where those all are yet. So can't really speak.
I'm not sure anybody does.
give me a little more time, and specifies regular reporting with the legislature on implementing the legislation and adopting rules. So that's really the sum total of it, and I'll pass it on to Pat, but I'll stand for questions as well at the end. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I'm the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And really, I think my role here today is to speak on behalf of the Enterprise Leadership Team, which is the 20 or so agency heads who, for about the last 2.5 years, really for the first time in state government in Oregon, have been working as a fully functioning executive level management team for state government as an enterprise. And I really want to make 3 points about this from that perspective. The first, just in terms of the ELT, the Enterprise Leadership Team, I've been around state government for a bit, and I think the cardinal difference between this approach, the ELT approach, to whether it's IT governance or other kinds of enterprise management decisions is really a shared decision-making and shared accountability kind of a model where instead of in past years where you'd sit in your own agency and you'd see Department of Administrative Services go off and launch an initiative, and you'd look and think, well, I wonder how that's going to turn out, and you'd sort of be a bystander to it. We really share ownership for the decision making as a part of this IT governance system, as well as other enterprise issues, and that's really different, and that adds a qualitative difference to how these decisions get discussed and how they get made at the enterprise level. The second thing, from my own narrow agency perspective, I need stuff to work. I need enterprise investments in enterprise infrastructure that works so that I can do the projects that I need to do. I need shared service opportunities where I'm making an investment in something that someone else is making, that we can figure out how one of us can make the investment and both of us use it, or those kinds of circumstances that are easy to deliver and can work. And I need to be able to then devote my staff's time and attention and resources to things that are narrowly our kinds of projects, and be able to have the resource to do that, and be able to not spend lots of money on duplicating things that other people could be doing because I don't trust that they work. And this structure, I think, sets us up as well as we can possibly be set up to be able to have the dependency that things will work and be able to be dependable. And that really leads to the third point, which is I'd like to be able to reduce my investment in IT infrastructure and applications and really focus on the things that are are critical and core and unique to my own organization and have those investments really be the things that are standalone for me. And having a system where, through the strategic technology officers, we're able to identify true enterprise-wide infrastructure and make those investments successfully, truly shared service investments, and make those successfully is really important. I could tick off any number of examples of circumstances where, you know, what I find is we need to make some kind of an investment, and my first question is, well, we can't be the first ones to have needed to do this. Can we use whatever exists at whatever other agency? And the answer comes back incredibly frustrating, but incredibly logically, which is, well, so when we did this stuff, we used these tools and these platforms and these systems, and those all made sense for us, and that agency made different choices that were all completely logical for it, and as a result, we're at a place where now it's very difficult to get them to work or talk together, and having the strategic technology and officer structure to be able to have those conversations at a much earlier stage, I think, can keep us from making those sorts of logical choices that take us to a place that gets to an illogical conclusion. With that, I think Mike and Alex are prepared to answer any questions that you might have.
that was good. So questions from the committee? Representative Lively.
So I appreciate, and I think this is a great effort, and hopefully will lead to things. It's always astonishing when I hear a figure like 1,000 more applications than. But I, coming from the private sector, I know that happens in the private sector too. Unfortunately, I'm trying to understand more closer though the link between the applications, the software, and the hardware, because in many cases they don't. Even if you have the right one, if you don't have the correct hardware, and my impression oftentimes in government we're behind also on the hardware side. So I'm trying to understand how these, as we're doing all this, how we bring that together.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair Lively, let me give a very high level answer. I may defer to Alex regarding software hardware relationships, but the real effort here is not only in a new governance structure to be able to coordinate, elevate, advise individual agencies or programs that are trying to make software application kinds of decisions, but also for us a venue that is recognized and accepted for us to make collective decisions about larger scale investments like infrastructure. Like networking, those kinds of investments that cut across the entire enterprise. And so at least from a governance perspective, this structure is not only meant to chase down individual applications, but also for us to be able to make these larger decisions around the structure, particularly infrastructure kinds of investments.
Well, so in Oklahoma, the very first thing that I was charged to do, sorry, Mr. Chairman, Vice Chairman Lively, I'll get used to this. The first thing I was charged to do was to produce a report identifying specifically the number of applications in Oklahoma. There were 4,092 applications. We identified those using a software tool called BDNA. It went on the wire. It articulated and identified every single specific, but that was both operating system, or I say both, that was operating system, middleware, as well as applications. So it really depends upon when we're speaking of or we're trying to identify what does application mean. In many cases, those applications were the same application like Microsoft Office across all agencies. Mm-hmm. One of the things that this enabled us to do, however, was to say that my Microsoft Office was the same as Pat's Microsoft Office was the same as. So the state, instead of having 15 different enterprise license agreements with each agency, we unified it and had one license agreement with all agencies across the state that the entire state used, so we all were on the same Microsoft Office. That was particularly beneficial for small agencies. However, there's Adobe, there's Oracle, there are a variety of applications that are, I don't want to say universal, but very largely universal across organizations. That was really our first iteration, was the articulation of what those. After that, you get into standardizing your middleware components. And lastly, those pieces to that really touch the end user. However, what is important, and kind of to more specifically perhaps to where your question was, as we identify initiatives or strategic things that leaders of agencies wish to pursue, we can find where if perhaps there is something that they're going to look at or do. Maybe there isn't something, there may or may not be something we can use internally, but there may be something they can move towards where in the future others could use it, or even open source solutions that we could embrace as a state and promote.
Representative Kangar.
A couple quick questions, and then maybe a longer one if the chair permits. Where are the three pilot? Which three offices are you piloting?
We are piloting in the health human service mm-hmm. sector, education, and the economy and jobs group.
It's pretty big.
Yeah, well, yeah, the suites of agencies are five, actually six. We have an administrative group also. So we're going to try it in three, mm-hmm. and we're going to pilot this year, as I said, and then we think that we'll work out kinks and then budget for the full implementation next biennium.
Okay, so another quick question. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mr. Pivot, welcome to Oregon. You talked about trying to find where all the advisory boards are and streamlining that if necessary. Are you talking about within Department of Administrative Services or within your just within the CIO office?
Mr. Chairman,
or throughout all the agencies?
And the direct answer is yes. We wish to try to find where governance fits overall in our model. Governance is very important to us as we go through. But
across all state agencies, you're talking about then.
And particularly focusing, though, on the three that we've... It is... So the previous opportunity I had to speak before a committee was my introduction, and in that I had said that I'm a firm believer in incremental delivery. That's the thing that in my experience directly in Oklahoma and in previous the city of Denton, Texas, and other places I've been, incremental delivery is the key to accomplishing great things. So as we work our way through these first three areas or business segments, if you like, we're going to find things within them that we don't expect right now. And to be able to have the opportunity to address those comprehensively is going to be, and without trying to take on too much at once. And that's really my mantra is to do things, is to segment them and to deal with them one at a time.
If I may, Mr. Yeah. Chairman, just to add, Representative Kenny Geyer, that we're really speaking about different committees that have been brought together around IT governance issues, not necessarily the 300-plus
right.
Boards and commissions and other task forces that we have in state government.
Okay, thank you. And then the last question, and Mr. Chair, you can feel free to tell not to answer it if you want, but I can't resist but ask you about Cover Oregon, because I see my great chair of the healthcare committee behind me, and we've been talking about what should the management be, given that it's not really a state agency, it's quasi-independent, and of course there's big questions about Oracle in that. And so I just wonder if there's time for you to make any comment about how this might fit into your long-term vision of how you do oversight of entities that receive significant public money. And so we have some obligation to do oversight, but where does that oversight lie? But yours is really more of an operational, you know, assistance. How do you give technical assistance to a group? So
I'll step in at this point. This particular bill doesn't, I don't believe, envision that aspect. I think the next bill that we will be hearing will speak to that directly.
So you're off the hook, I guess.
Is he speaking to that bill, too?
I
have the CIO here and not ask that question.
I have a question. Could you mention
Representative
that?
Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It does come back to Cover Oregon because, as I read the bill, I'm trying to figure out what teeth this really has. I mean, you know, this is going to give you the ability to really move us toward a common set of software. I mean, are you going to have the ability to do that? There's discussion in the bill about hiring for larger than $1 million contracts quality assurance teams with Cover Oregon. We hired them, and then the agency failed to follow their recommendations. I mean, would you help me understand how does this really enable DAS to more efficiently do its job to ensure that the people's money is appropriately utilized in areas of IT projects.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Richardson, really, this bill and the bill that put the state CIO's position in statute, I think, now clearly give the state CIO the authority, and this structure now gives the state CIO more capability to do the things that you're talking about. Through the statute that was passed last session and some enhancements in this bill, requires the state CIO to, for instance, to coordinate all of those plans and projects across the entire enterprise. I will give a caveat in the sense that I think as to the structure of the business relationships in Cover Oregon, I think we have work to do together with the legislature in the future regarding optimizing those business relationships and structures so that appropriate oversight and coordination can be put in place. There is no question that this is a, how should I say, we have a highly fragmented organization, right? 90-ish agencies, 300 boards and commissions, at least on an org chart, they all report to one guy. And so we need to figure out ways, and we're hoping that this IT governance structure we're attempting to put in place gives capability to the authority that we think we have to do coordination and oversight.
If I might add, I think that succinctly states the legal authority issue, but I think the part that I would come back to is, again, the enterprise leadership team role in this. Mm-hmm. This doesn't represent an idea cooked up by the Department of Administrative Services for how this ought to work. This is a recommendation by the enterprise leadership team to the department and to the legislature about how to govern IT investments and IT projects in the state. And a part of the conversation that we had around that table was this means different behavior by those of us sitting here as agency directors in terms of how we deal with our own agency issues. And what we have is, again, back to that shared accountability and shared decision-making model, buy-in that this is how we're going to make these kinds of decisions. And so I think in addition to the statutory authority, it's backed up by the management team will of those gathered around that table to guide and shape those decisions.
So thank you. And if I might, I see this bill largely as building the infrastructure you need to help deal with IT throughout the state, and actually this whole process started last session before Cover Oregon was discovered to have all these problems. Not Cover Oregon, I should say, but the IT portion of the project. So, you know, I think this is really a bigger picture. You know, it's not about one particular issue, and that's what really excites me about seeing this infrastructure move forward. And, you know, we definitely need to work on some accountability as well, and I think we'll have a little more discussion about that in the next session. So, Representative Kinney-Geyer.
I just know one of the three areas is Health and Human Services, mm-hmm. and it was because of wanting to redo some of the IT around that impacted the Cover Oregon. Mm-hmm. It made the Cover Oregon a lot more complicated because of some of the updating that you wanted to do in that system. So there's a lot of interplay there, mm-hmm. and then you've got an outlier, and so how does that management-wise and governance-wise come into it? Right. But the IT question was very relevant to mm-hmm. that, and you're about to do a pilot in that, and that's the reason I bring it up.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Lively.
Just a quick question. I just need to understand. So at the end of the day, who's the decision maker? I love this coordination and all that, but who makes the final decision then about proceeding or not?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Lively. The coupling of last session's bill, 3258, and our ability to put capability behind that leaves the decision ultimately from a managerial perspective with the CIO. If you'll recall 3258, the CIO works directly with me and for the governor, so that's where the buck stops.
And we have the team that you spoke
about.
Yep,
and the leadership team is really, it is a tool and structure that over the last two or three years, I believe, has moved this organizationally fractured organization to a place where we make collective decisions about where we're going on a number of issues, IT being one of them.
So just real briefly, I have one question. At the the ultimate goal, recognizing that you got the three I would call very large pilots. Mm-hmm. Going forward, is this going to encompass all state government?
Executive branch. We're working on all six areas, which would encompass all agencies.
Branch. All right.
Yes.
Okay.
That's correct.
All right. Thank you very much
for the
presentation, and thank you for bringing this bill forward for us. Up next, I know we have someone from the private sector, representing the private sector, who would like to make an addition to this bill. And it is, I believe the committee has this, the -1 amendment. So I'll have Jim Gardner come up and explain to us a little bit about the -1 and what the purpose of this amendment is.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm here today representing Microsoft. We did see this very, very forward-looking piece of legislation and thought that there might be an opportunity to make an addition to it, which would further the purpose of good governance and best practices in the field of IT, specifically the field of IT outsourcing. This amendment basically is a precautionary amendment which says that when the government contracts with third-party vendors of IT services, it must ensure that that third party will not turn around and use the data acquired for essentially its own pecuniary interest in terms of marketing, sales, advertising, etc. That's basically what the amendment does. And it does have a couple of safeguards that were very important that were ably addressed by your committee administrator in an exchange with Mr. Jordan. Specifically, the bill is not intended to in any way interfere with Oregon's e-government vendor, because that is the state's agent, and the state's agent is specifically carved out from the it's simply a third-party vendor. In addition, the use of DMV records and hunting licenses, where the state actually gains revenue from those for sales, that's not covered either, because that's the state acting for its own interest, and that's outside the scope of the bill. And finally, the use of data for very important purposes such as heat mapping across education sectors, etc., that is not affected by the bill. So I had a brief conversation with Mr. Jordan. I believe that they have come to a similar conclusion. And we did run this bill by the governor's office and before we this amendment, and they did not have an objection to it.
Okay. Questions? Representative Richardson.
I have one. Thank you for bringing this forward. I think the intent is great. I have a question about whether or not there will be unintended consequences from the wording of the amendment, because it says that the chief information officer shall ensure that a person other than a state employee or agent of a state employee may not sell for commercial gain, pecuniary benefit, the data. Okay? And so essentially it does exclude from that requirement not to use it for commercial gain those that are not affiliated with the government, but it allows those that do by implication. And is that an intentional thing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, it is, because it's intended to allow, for instance, DMV, which does market, I believe, to insurance companies, data. It's intended mm-hmm. to allow that existing function to continue, hunting license data, that sort of thing. It is intended to allow that practice, which is an existing practice, which we don't really see any opportunity or risk of privacy compromise or of the kind of problem that could develop with the main focus of the bill. We don't see that in that context.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, my concern is that while it says that you're not going to be able, that it essentially says that those that are working with the government can do profiling of users and their family members, can sell for commercial gain and so forth. I don't know if there's any preclusion in state law presently that would prevent an employee of the state from taking the data, the information that's obtained, and utilizing it in a way that for their own gain, but they're essentially exempted from any liability or prevention from doing that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, yeah, it was not our intent to reach. It was simply an attempt to address what we received as a sort of large segment of the problem. But there may be others that other areas that down the road we'd want to address as well.
Thank you. That's an interesting point you're making.
We have the bill. We have the relating clause. If we're going to do it, we may want to ask if this would not be an appropriate time to also ensure that state workers and agencies or those agents for the state do not utilize availability or access to data in a way that would violate privacy, that would profile citizens of, you know, in any way that would be for personal gain or for in a way that's not acceptable. Yeah. So I just mentioned that to you.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Gardner? Thank you, Ms. Gardner. I appreciate it. I think this is a well-intended amendment, and I appreciate Microsoft bringing it forward. So we don't have anyone else signed up for House Bill 4135, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4135. We will not be working the bill today, nor any bill today, actually. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 4122. Jen, give us a brief description of House Bill 4122, please.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm going to talk about the measure with the dash one incorporated into it. So the measure with the one defines what an IT procurement is, and it requires a state contracting agency or public corporation to obtain a quality management services from a qualified contractor on IT procurements that exceed $5 million, or if the IT procurement meets three or more of the specified criteria. Allows state contracting agency or the public corporation to procure preliminary quality management services if the IT procurement meets standards that are described above. Requires the state contracting agency and public corporation to consult with the DAS director and follow DAS policies and procedures on these IT procurements. And it requires the compliance with tax laws of the state and local jurisdictions and specifies that anyone who's the bidder or the proposer to submit an affidavit attesting compliance with these tax laws becomes operative in July 2014, declares an emergency effective on passage. And there is a dash two, I'm sorry, it just came in, and that addresses the definition of a public corporation.
Thank you, yes. It was brought to our attention. We wanted to make sure we weren't including local governments in this. I think that dash two accomplishes that. So with that, I'd like to call up Representative Nathanson and Representative Greenlick. Sponsors of the bill. So good afternoon. I know you're probably anxiously looking out the window going, when can I get out of here?
Reading traffic reports.
So thank you this afternoon. If you would like to go ahead and give us a little preview of the bill and what we're trying to accomplish here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from House District 13. We, the representatives of Oregon, need to ensure that information technology projects will be managed better in the future. This bill puts in place a process so that significant projects will have additional scrutiny, the oversight they need to keep things from going south, or if they have started to go sideways, someone to step in and do a mid-course correction. This bill addresses design and implementation of new IT projects. It is adding a layer of mandatory oversight that currently doesn't exist. It even applies to agencies with delegated authority to do their own purchasing. Virtually every department in state government has IT projects. looking at information that was available from a November 2013 list, it shows that the investment value of IT projects on the books at that time, November 2013, had a total value of nearly $560 million for 17 projects. Those ranged from about $2 million, like the planning phase of ODOT's DMV driver license issuance replacement project, to about $230 million for the state radio project. That's the one providing communications for law enforcement, fire, transportation, and others throughout the whole state. There are three distinct elements to our proposal, which is the bill, the Dash 1 amendment, which you've heard about, the Dash 2, and possibly other amendments not yet finished. The three main components of the idea are to define when a project must have separate third-party quality assurance review, to get copies of that report to people in key positions so that someone else will be reading it and in a position to do something about it, and finally, to keep tax evaders from securing contracts for these projects. So, taking a step back for a minute, what is quality assurance for IT? I'm going to read to you the language that Department of Administrative Services has put in place because I don't want to miss it. It sounds really bureaucratic. The purpose of the contractor's work is to assure that appropriate levels of quality management activities are performed throughout the project lifecycle and or for a specific portion of the project lifecycle. These activities shall provide the agency with appropriate visibility into the processes being used and the products being built in the project, especially by its design, development, and implementation contractor. The quality management activities must be sufficient to assure that the project satisfies the needs for which it was undertaken and that project risks are well understood and appropriately mitigated or managed. And there's a lot of other language which I can provide you. QA, or quality assurance contracts, can be for the whole process of the design and implementation of a project, or they can be separated by the planning phase and then the implementation phase. There's one currently going on that the Legislative Fiscal Office has been tracking, where the planning phase was worth about $2 million, and then the implementation, or where you actually do the project and put it in place, was worth about $40 million. There's an example. The Human Resource Information System is in the business planning stage right now, and there is a QA vendor on board. If the legislature approves moving forward, there will be a new RFP for the vendor to do it, and then also a contract for quality assurance. But that's an example of a project being split between planning, and then if there's legislative approval, then you have the next phase. So one might ask, how many projects would qualify under the bill the way it's written, and especially as the committee administrator has explained with the Dash 1 amendment in place? In fiscal year 2012-13, there were 18 projects over $1 million. But for projects that would have met at least two other criteria, you know, there's a list, it takes three to kick in if it's under $5 million. For projects that would have met at least two other criteria beyond the $1 million, there are just nine contracts that would have been applicable, and those totaled about $50 million worth of project work. This bill does not slow down or add cost to routine business. It excludes run-of-the-mill information technology work, but it sure will get at those larger projects automatically where the contract is over $5 million or, as you've seen in the Dash 1, meeting criteria. The most important, there are five or six listed there. The most important, though, are over $1 million, projects that are mission critical, and projects that are designed, managed, or used by multiple agencies. So in thinking about what's mission critical, you would I believe, agree that state police dispatch and records would be mission critical. Online applications for licenses and permits would be mission critical. So would the new system that's being designed for child welfare information. But not mission critical, fleet management. That isn't something that's life or death. It's not affecting individual Oregonians in their ability to get their business done on a daily basis. So perhaps fleet management doesn't rise to the level of being called mission critical. Designed, managed, or used by multiple agencies. One of the good examples of that is the business registry, which is used by the Secretary of State, the Departments of Revenue, Employment, Consumer and Business Services, and the private sector. Now, that's pretty darned important when you have that many agencies and the private sector all depending on this. The system design and implementation needs to go well. This bill also gives rulemaking authority to DAS, Department of Administrative Services, the Attorney General, and to contracting agencies so that they can add additional detail about implementing this or clarify or define something that needed additional definition. We want to be sure that this QA report is seen by more eyes. The amendment we will be developing will make sure that it goes to people who can review it and do something about it if it looks like something is necessary, not just go to someone who was a single manager who can say thank you and just put the report in a drawer. We will continue to fine-tune the words here and there over the next couple of days. For example, in the sections referring to the value of the contract versus the value of the project. We don't want any loopholes in this. We don't want to let agencies off the hook. We want all of these projects to have good oversight. So we'll continue to work on this over the next couple of days. We want this to be a very solid first step. We imagine that there is more that we could and should be doing. I continue digging into this. Others as well, I know, are looking into it. There will very likely be more ideas that come back for the next legislative session. But for right now, for what we can get done in a short session, this is a good, solid first step. We want to make sure that we keep project failures and projects that have gone sideways from happening again in the future.
Thank you. Representative Greenlick, do you have anything to add?
Just very briefly, Mr. Chair. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, and I'm really happy to be here to help present this bill. I spent 30 years as the chief knowledge officer in the public sector, and watched lots of instances where complicated IT projects went bad. I watched the organization I worked with spend $750 million on a project that didn't come to fruition for a variety of reasons. We have state administrative rules that bring most state agencies under this type of model right now, but we don't have it codified in statute, and we don't have it covering other kinds of public corporations such as Cover Oregon or SAFE or a number of other potential organizations. It was very interesting to listen to our CIO talk about his new set of responsibilities. What this is intended to do is to give the CIO some better access to information about projects that may be going bad. Having these kind of quality projects along with other IT projects is really getting more and more common, and it really, we think it ought to be a part of the everyday work of IT projects in the state. We've seen lots of them have problems. Those of us that have been around have experienced a variety of IT problems across the state, and I think the creation of a CIO is an important first step, but we think this is a way to give the CIO some more tools to help assure that as we spend $500 million of state money, it gets spent in a way that makes some sense.
Thank you. Just a quick question. It's kind of, do we have an idea of what a quality assurance contract would cost? I mean, as far as, you know, what percentage of the contract?
Yes, Mr. Chair. In consulting with Legislative Fiscal Office, it looks like the cost of doing QA is about 4 to 6% of the total project cost.
Right. And you had mentioned yet another amendment coming that was going to be able to make sure these reports got to somebody besides just the CIO.
Well,
can you elaborate on that just a little bit?
Mr. Chair, I think Representative Richardson made an important point about what happened under Cover Oregon, where there were some people that knew things were going wrong. We didn't have anybody independent like the CIO to gather that data and do something about it. And that information may not have even gone to the board of the organization. What we want to make sure is that when this information comes up, it's not buried somewhere, that that there's the clear way that the CIO has it, has authority to use it, and that other important people find out about, such as the board of directors or whoever is the supervisor of the state agencies in ways that matter. So we think that may,
that, that's
may
take
a little
the next
up.
Amendment looks like. Okay. Any other questions? Representative Kinnegar?
I just have a lay question because I'm having a hard time understanding it really clearly. Right, so this bill says what is the current situation, who's covered, and in this bill, who's covered now that wasn't covered before? Is it you're adding public corporations? Like, who, just really like lay terms. Name some. Is it Cover Oregon, SAFE, OHSU? Who is covered into this bill that used to not be covered?
Mr. Chair, and Representative Kenny Geyer, yes, Cover Oregon would now for certain be included. There are some, there are still exclusions that exist. In the way we've written the bill, because we wanted the, frankly, the best shot at getting something with teeth in it passed in this short session, we're not trying to bite off more than we can chew right now. There are exemptions which exist in statute right now for contracting generally. For example, we do not have oversight authority, direct oversight over the judicial branch contracting, at least the way I understand it. There are exemptions for OHSU and the Oregon University System. And we can provide a more detailed list. Actually, I've been trying to reconcile lists that I've gotten from three different sources of who's included and who's excluded, and Legislative Council is looking into that right now to try to reconcile the understandings, because it's covered in different parts of statute where those contracting exemptions are. And what we're trying to do is make sure that the most critical places that are doing IT projects, again, what we can pass in a short session, that we can address those regardless of their exemptions that exist in other parts of statute with regard to delegated authority. Right now, through statute or through rule making by Department of Administrative Services, there is delegated authority so that some departments do their own contracting. And in fact, I have a couple of examples I could point out. For example, Department of Transportation buys a certain kind of paint that must be able to stand up to wear and tear, temperature, conditions about reflectivity and so forth. The person reviewing vendors for a pretty large, expensive contract like that, you want people who are expert in knowing how to evaluate vendors and products for that, for paint, not someone whose expertise is in getting the best value for office supplies. for example. So certain kinds of things.
That's built into this bill.
That's explaining why we have delegated authority in some cases.
But the short answer in this is that state agencies are covered under the statute, or they used to be covered under administrative rule, mm-hmm. and some of the public corporations are included that weren't included before under any model.
And certainly under our public contracting code already, there are some exemptions like the OUS and OHSU, and, you know, for practical reasons, we've delegated some independence there, and to bring them back into the public contracting code would be a monumental drafting task throughout statute. Not something that we wanted to undertake at this point.
So I get that's very helpful. Thank you. And the last line of the background of the measure summary says OHA. It says exceptions include but not limited to Oregon Health Authority and public corporations such as Cover Oregon. So this is deliberately including Cover Oregon. What about Oregon Health Authority?
I think Oregon Health Authority is covered by this.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I just confused the last mm-hmm. line of the background. Maybe you can look at later and help me right. understand that. And then one other question, just trying to understand the Amendment 1. It used to have, if you hit 1 million, you had to be subject to this, and the amendment changes it to 5 million plus three circumstances? Is it changing that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kenny Geyer, the original bill was anything over $1 million. The Dash 1 amendment changes it. It's either mm-hmm. over 5 million mm-hmm. or meets at least three of a set of criteria. Mm-hmm. One of those criteria is $1 million, mm. and then there are some others also.
It's five criteria.
You have to meet
at least three of the criteria if it's $1 million.
I see.
I think it also makes clear the specification is that we're talking about IT projects and not
right.
and not other
I get
kinds
it.
Of
You're just raising right. the bar a bit. If it's $1 million, it's also got to have two other, because otherwise too much would be included, fiscal would be too high, I'm assuming. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Richardson.
I have one. Thank you, and thanks for bringing this forward. I want to make sure I understand one of the provisions in the summary, and I've been looking at it in the wording, says that it provides an exemption from the requirement that state contracting agency not accept a bid. So basically, what I'm reading is that if a company gives input as to what the requirements are for the bid, they would be able to also now be able to bid on the contract. Is that correct? Because I can read the sentence. Provides exemption from requirement that the state contracting agency not accept a bid or proposal from a contractor that assisted in developing the specifications or solicitation documents for the bid or proposal for certain quality management services. Mm-hmm. And so if what I'm reading there and what I'm trying to decipher in the bill is correct, it's saying that a company that helps create the specifications can bid on the project. Well, I want to be able to be that company, because I'll say you have to have 8 years experience. Of course, I have 8.1 years experience, and you have to have at least 10 contracts in Oregon, because I've got 10 contracts. I mean, I can develop specifications that would only limit the qualifying company to, guess what, my own. And so,
I'm not aware that's in the bill. You know, we're not responsible for summaries, so it's
Chair.
Useful.
Okay. If you look of the bill, not the amendment, of the bill, page 4, it's the new language starting on line 13.
Section. Okay, got it. Yeah, that's what I'm looking for.
Of the bill.
So the language, it's saying that the language of section
3,
which mm-hmm. is existing statute, does not apply to somebody who is the bidder or the proposer of for quality management services. That a state contracting agency receives from a contractor that provided the preliminary quality assurance services for the same procurement that is the subject of the solicitation. So that is my understanding.
That's what I read, too.
That currently, if the contracting agency hires somebody to help them prepare the solicitation documents, they cannot then receive a bid from that person to get the job. So they've
it cannot.
They've hired somebody to
presently
help them design the solicitation to get everything right in what they're asking the project people to bid on. That person then cannot turn around and bid on the job.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah?
This is changing that.
Mr. Chair, could I add something?
You bet.
I think it's important to distinguish bidding on the job to actually implement the system versus bidding on the next phase of quality assurance to do the QA for the implementation. In other words, a quality assurance contractor might be overseeing how the department is writing the business case and the plan for how the system should be designed. That quality assurance vendor may also be interested in assuring that the project is built to the specifications that the QA vendor would not be actually doing the implementation or building the system. The QA vendor would be overseeing to make sure that someone was doing it right. Did that
Mr.
help?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
In Cover, Oregon, at Maximus, great company, got paid $1 million for their QA work, and then they also did IV work. I'm not sure what that stood for. That was another $2 million. So they had $3 million that they earned in doing the job that they did, and they did it very well. If the wording does what I think it does, then this is a change in my understanding of how the statutes normally work in Oregon, I mean how the system works, which is if you're going to help develop the requirements for the RFP, then you can't bid on the job. Whether it's for QA services or building a bridge, it's the same kind of thing because you've got to avoid the inherent conflict of interest that you would have if you right. can help do
and
that.
And I understand what you're saying, but I don't think that the quality assurance contractor is designing the RFP specifically.
Or the QA. I mean, providing the quality assurance work.
Contract. They're not preparing the RFP for that.
Which line?
They're a bidder or proposer for that contract.
Can I just need clarification?
That's my understanding. So I think you're confusing the specifications for the RFP with the quality assurance contract and the person that's bidding on that. We can get a clarification from legal counsel on that, but I'm...
Because each of you hire all have an RFP.
Correct, but I do not believe that the quality assurance contractor is designing the RFP for the quality assurance contract.
I understand what you're saying.
Can I ask which lines we're talking about on page 4?
He's talking, I think it's on page 4.
Page 4 of the original contract, on the original bill.
Mm-hmm. In the original bill, page 4, lines 13 through 17. And so I don't believe that they're designing the specifications for the RFP is what I'm
all right, because
I think that's
can we get a clarification on what that really means? Thank you.
Yeah, I think it means that they can also, besides doing the quality assurance contract, that they can also provide quality management services.
Okay. So Mr. Chair, also yes. on this bill. It appears to me that what this bill is doing is what we actually did with Cover Oregon. I mean, we did not approve the accepting of the federal grant unless there was quality assurance, quality control, cutoff periods, oversight, and all of those things. And so we need to make sure that that is required on other large projects. But what we learned in Cover Oregon is those that are doing the project may not pay any attention to
right.
it, and so there has to be oversight.
And I would argue that we didn't do exactly what this bill proposes under Cover Oregon because there weren't some of the requirements that are in this on that project.
Okay. So there also was a CIO in place in
right.
the state.
And we're also mandating that the public corporation, because previous public corporations weren't required or had any requirement to go through quality assurance. Cover Oregon may have had quality assurance, but it didn't have the checks and balances that are contained in this.
Well, I think it's a good bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, that if I might.
Yes.
That's correct. We're going through this bill and an amendment that you don't have in front of you, but which I've described. I guess you would say it's a conceptual amendment.
Right, right.
That a CIO, a COO, chief operating officer, and a governing board or other appropriate officer.
Like an agency head or...
Yes, would all receive copies of the QA report. We want more than one set of eyes to see that and be aware of whether things are looking pretty good or things are going sideways. So
that requirement didn't exist.
But it happened in Cover, Oregon. Don't tell us it didn't happen. I mean, everybody got to see it. They just didn't pay any attention to it.
The requirement in Cover, Oregon was a federal requirement, and there was an agency who reported to the federal government who...
No.
Stamped it all along the way as being working.
The requirement for Cover, Oregon was placed by the co-chairs of Ways and Means in order to accept the initial $48 million grant. Mm-hmm. We said we're not going to accept it unless there is this kind of quality control, and so it all put in place. The federal government has its own requirements, but those requirements were not part of what was required for us to accept the grant. So, but anyway, it doesn't matter. That's another decision, another discussion.
Yeah, it is, and I think that this bill is looking also more globally. It's not just about Cover, Oregon.
Well, what can we learn?
You know, and so I think we're taking a major step with this bill in the correct direction of having accountability, I believe. Not that I'm, you know, speaking from down there, but...
Since you are one of the sponsors.
Yeah, well, actually, I am the sponsor on this bill. Yeah, well, I'm intimately familiar with some of the pieces of this bill.
Clarification, this bill adds who would see the quality assurance, because the point is Cover, Oregon had quality assurance. Who saw it? Who did anything with it?
Who was required to see
it? But in this, it adds... Because it's not in the bullets in the measure.
That's the amendment that's coming yet.
The amendment that's coming is who will see and act upon this.
In addition to the CIO.
Right. Correct.
Great.
And it also puts it in statute instead of existing only in administrative rule.
Right.
Or contract by contract.
Yeah. Correct, correct. Yeah. So we'll have a consistent policy on this throughout state government. So without anything else you'd like to add, I think you guys have done a great job, I think Representative Nathanson and Representative Griegman have done a great job on presenting this, and really thank you for the effort that's gone into it. I know that we've all been involved in trying to think about how we, you know, move forward with IT, because it's so specialized and impacts so many pieces of our state government. And I think along with the previous bill, those two pieces are absolutely critical for us going forward, and I think potentially will save us a lot of revenue in the future. So
thank you for hearing us, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for coming down and taking your time in the snowy afternoon. Good luck getting home.
And you.
I think I'm stuck.
It says you're saying.
Did we have anybody else? Oh, we do. Joe Basler and Andrea Salinas.
I think it's saying if you were hired to provide the preliminary, you can now be hired.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Jerome,
I was gazing off at the snowflakes or something.
My name is Joe Basler. I'm represent Oregon AFSCME Council 75. We represent about 24,000 members, public employees mostly in the state. You know, I don't have a lot to add about the bill, but we're very supportive of the concept and very supportive of moving forward to be. More oversight on public contracts. One of the biggest frustrations our members have is when a public contract goes bad, it paints government and government workers with the same brush, even though they have very little control. And even though a lot of times frontline workers are the ones jumping up and down, waving their hands, saying, this is going bad. And it's an incredibly frustrating thing to be like, have no control, see the problem, and then get blamed for the problem after it happens. And so anything we can do to move forward, have more accountability, it's a short session, so I will not to demand a much broader, crazier, more awesome bill. But I'm going to next session. Dad's probably not going to like it. You know, as we like to say, those who are trusted with the public money should be trustworthy. And I wish I could say that was mine. It's not. It's nice, though. And so thank you very much for hearing this bill. We think it's a good step forward.
Thank you.
Chair Hulvey, members of the committee, my name is Andrea Salinas. I'm the contract lobbyist for SEIU Local 503. And SEIU has worked on this issue in multiple sessions, and we issued a report during the 2011 session that highlighted issues around contracting, and we believe this bill is on track. And in light of the contracting problems at Cover Oregon, this bill is particularly timely. SEIU has signed up nearly 5,000 of its members through Cover Oregon, so our staff and members have been on the front lines of realizing the difficulties and problems of the rollout with Oregon's health insurance exchange. However, we have enrolled 5,000 members who, before this program, did not have health care, and we consider that a success for us. So despite the problems, we think this bill and is a good first step in a solution to this problem. SEIU has many, many success stories, and some of you heard some of them yesterday in the healthcare committee, and that's really why we're here today. We think contract failures have hurt Oregonians' ability to sign up for health insurance, and we must make sure this never happens again. We need to make sure that whether it's Cover Oregon or any other big contracting project, that we have the checks and balances in place to ensure the taxpayer money is being spent wisely and efficiently. And we do believe that this bill takes the necessary first steps to ensure that any future contracting projects put into place those checks and balances. So we urge your support of this bill.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Don't see any Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, in respect to the workers that have to work on these contracts, I would suggest that the CIO work to have an 800 number and a way for those that are working on contracts to be able to call and report a whistleblowing opportunity without the possibility of retaliation for them, because they're the ones working. And in Cover Oregon, there were many people that saw that there were problems, but you know, they're worried about their job, and there's risk. And so we need to make sure that we have clearly communicated an opportunity for those that think that there needs to be something looked at to be able to get in contact with the right people who will make the look, who are not in their line of chain of command.
That's a good point. I think I actually think that already exists, but to some degree. So that protection, whistleblower protection for
employees. It does exist. There is a number, but it's not widely known, and it wouldn't be advertised unless CIO says, you know, if there's any issues coming up on this project, please mm-hmm. let us know. Here's the mm-hmm. number. I think mm-hmm. that would be great to be posted.
Yeah. So thank you very much for your testimony today. Appreciate always the from the workforce, you know, helping us through some of these issues where people that are actually on the ground involved can point out some options for us. I know Sean Brennan, you're a very busy guy. If I know you took your time to come here and perhaps address our discussion of the bid and proposal issue and whether the quality assurance vendor was actually designing the RFP specifications for bidding on that project. So,
Chair Hulvey, Representative Richardson, as I understand the question, you were concerned about the effect of the amendment to 279B040. That's in Section 2 of the bill, I believe. Or Section 3, I'm sorry.
We were looking at Section 3.
Okay.
Of the original bill.
And I did.
Oh, and would you introduce yourself for the record?
Sean Brennan, Legislative Counsel, before the committee. I didn't hear the question, unfortunately. If you'd like to repeat it, I'd be very happy to try and answer it.
Sure, I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair. The question is, does anything in this bill enable anyone who is involved in the drafting of the specifications, the solicitation specifications, to also be able to bid to perform the actual services?
Thank you. Chair Holvey, Representative Richardson, the actual function of 279B040 is to try and eliminate that possibility with respect to the procurement for the services themselves. However, in the Legislative Fiscal Office, somebody pointed out that many of the contractors who perform QA services, quality assurance services, are often involved in the preliminary drafting of specifications so that they can figure out what the market is like, what the specifications and possible business solutions for an IT project might be, and they are intimately involved in drafting the specifications. They were finding, however, that these same contractors who might well be interested in performing quality assurance services during the actual performance of the contract, they were not bidding on the preliminary quality assurance services because they thought that they would be and unable to perform the services later, and that was discouraging them from actually applying to do this very valuable service of helping draft specifications. So the amendment that's to 279C040 in this bill is meant to take care of that situation by allowing contractors who are able to do the preliminary specification drafting and advice also to perform quality assurance services for the contract once it actually is bid out or awarded. The quality assurance contractors would not ordinarily be performing the actual services. They'd be doing the oversight and having the eye on the contract as it's being performed. So this bill still prevents those folks from actually performing the services that are the subject of the procurement. Their function would be only to provide quality assurance, and this amendment allows them to perform the specification drafting and the quality assurance oversight, but not the specification drafting and perform the services that are the subject of the procurement. That is under 279C040 forbidden, unless you have the director of DAS's approval under certain circumstances that are outlined in the statute.
So it doesn't
change. I thought I understood
that.
Until your last paragraph.
Okay.
May I clarify?
I understood it.
Okay. Is there a possibility, as an unintended consequence, that a quality assurance service that was provided when drafting the solicitation could also include in the solicitation requirements provisions relating to the quality assurance team that would provide the oversight to the actual project?
Chair Holvey, Representative Richardson, yes, that is a possibility.
Okay, so would it not be appropriate to say this power here shall not include any provisions relating to the services to be provided by the quality assurance team? I just don't want the deck to get stacked in favor of those that control the wording.
Understood, Chair Holvey, Representative Richardson. The difficulty with that has been, and the reason that this amendment exists at all, is because there actually have been instances where quality assurance contractors, many of whom are approved by DAS and listed as pre-qualified providers in this case, were simply refusing to bid on the quality assurance portion of that.
You're kind of repeating. I understand that. The question was, is there a way to adjust the wording so that we could get around the problem that causes people not to participate because they're afraid they won't be able to oversee the project itself by restricting their authority in the preliminary stage so that it cannot apply to the services provided by the quality assurance team, although it could everything else involved in the project?
Chair Holvey, Representative Richardson, I'm not sure I quite understand the thrust of that. I mean, I think I do, but at the same time, I'm trying to envision a situation where that kind of procurement would actually work. If I understand your question correctly, what you're saying is that if you have a contractor who's performing preliminary quality assurance services, helping to draft the specifications and so forth, you want them to not be able to do the oversight quality assurance later for the project?
No.
Or the other way around?
No, neither.
Neither.
What I'm saying is that if I'm the quality assurance guy and I'm being hired preliminarily to do the specifications, it would be appropriate for me to do that and to serve in overseeing the project so long as my specifications did not also determine who could qualify to be the QA team, because now I can stack the deck based on my own experience and exclude competition.
Chair Holvey, Representative Richardson, I understand, absolutely, and that was something I did give some thought to, but at the same time, when I was consulting with some of the folks who were ordinarily, or the DAS folks who were doing the pre-qualification for many of these vendors. They say that the vast majority of them, certainly all the ones that they have pre-qualified right now, and I think there are 11 such firms, they routinely will do both. That is, they'll do the preliminary specifications and then do the oversight. So the idea there is that they are supposed to do that. That's a valuable function for them to perform. There is a small possibility, I suppose, that you could draft the specifications during the QA, during the preliminary stage of the procurement, so that they themselves will inevitably become the QA provider in that case. And I think that actually is contemplated in many cases with this pre-qualification. Now, if we don't want that to happen as a policy matter, then certainly we could probably draft language and simply remove this amendment. That is, the existing language in 279C040 would say that if you are drafting specifications, giving advice to a contracting agency, then you are not prohibited, you are not able to do anything that's the subject of the procurement, including if the procurement includes QA services, then you would not be able to do QA services in that case as well.
Okay, may I go one more round, just really quick?
Yeah, sure.
Thank you. The goal is not to nullify what's trying to be accomplished here. It's just trying to refine it so that it can't be abused. And so if the QA team that's brought in for the preliminary specs, they're looking at the overall project and how do we have this project in such a way that it's likely to work because we understand how projects function. That's all fine. The only thing that I think should be restricted is any specifications or restrictions relating to what would take to qualify as a QA. Okay, just that one little area. Just, you know, this power shall not include specifications relating to the qualifications of the QA on the project so that it can't become a way to exclude other competition.
Chair Holby, Representative Richardson, I can give that certainly some more thought.
That's all I ask. Thank you.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, just so I'm clear on this as well, this piece doesn't allow the quality assurance vendor to actually provide the services for the IT project.
Chair Holby, that's correct. They won't. If you have a quality,
they're preparing. They do an RFP. They win the award for doing the specifications for the IT project. They're not allowed to do that and also perform the IT project, but they may have an RFP that says we want somebody to do the preliminary specifications and also oversee the project in one RFP. So they could end up doing both of those, but not actually, this bill won't allow them to actually do that plus do the whole IT project.
Chair Holby, that's correct.
Thank you. I was just making sure that was the case, because I can certainly envision an RFP that asks somebody to do the specifications and the oversight and accountability of the IT project, but they don't actually have the ability to write the specifications and actually do the work.
Yeah, well, my understanding is that this was about getting them in early when you're doing the specifications for the project.
Correct.
The specifications for the project can also include the specifications of what it takes to be the QA. And so if it crosses that line, then those that are in early can stack the deck so that they limit competition on who the QA can be. And so I think that they should not be able to go to that point.
You're looking for non-discriminatory language, something along the lines of the pecuniary interest.
Chair Holby, if I might, I think the perspective of Paul Siebert at LFO would be valuable for addressing the specific problem that you're asking about here. As I understand it, the with regard to DAS procurement, the default situation is an RFP like the one you described, where they ask for both preliminary QA and later for oversight, and that the firms that they do the contracts with tend to do both.
And that's what I understand, is usually those vendors do both those services in the RFPs. They don't normally, you know, carve those out separately. But, Representative Nathanson, you came back. Would you like to jump into this?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to assure you and the committee I'm listening very carefully to the issue that's being addressed, in particular by Representative Richardson. I'm taking notes. I understand exactly what the point is and the separation between recommendations for a project and recommendations for subsequent quality assurance. There should be separate contracts. There should be a separation of duties, and I'm making notes. I will work with both Legislative Fiscal Office and Legislative Council to see how we can get it right.
Thank you.
And I appreciate that, too, but I also do not want to lose the ability for an agency to do an RFP that hires a contractor to do the preliminary specifications and also the project oversight, accountability oversight in one RFP. I don't want to lose that because many of these companies are, from my understanding, these vendors actually do both. And that's one of the ways that we have
situation.
We have very good continuity and very good, you know, continuation to make sure that the specifications are being met. Just as in construction, you have an engineer that helps step in and do all the engineering specs and the construction specs, but they also provide the oversight to make sure those specs and those things are done properly and meet the specifications, and to separate, to prevent those, to insist that those be separate contracts, I think, provides
thank
great
you, Chair.
Danger.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting that if they're being hired, you want them to be from the beginning to the end.
Correct.
But if they're being brought in merely to help develop the specs, that's a different story.
Yeah.
And by the way, this comes back 30 years ago. A guy came in and told me how his crane company had been brought in by the state, not our state, to develop the specs for a huge project and what cranes could be used. And lo and behold, only his cranes qualified. It was just amazing how that worked out.
Yeah, and our public contracting codes contemplate that and prevent most of that. I'm not certain any law is actually foolproof. But,
Chair Hovey, it's with your indulgence, I just one more point on this. For 279C040, there actually is a mechanism set up that first, and the first line of defense prevents this from happening, and then the second line of defense gives an escape valve whereby a contracting agency that anticipates that they need services from both the for both specifications and providing the actual project, they are then able to go to the DAS director and say, look, we need to be able to do this, therefore can you sign off on this? We'll provide you the reasons. The DAS director looks at them and says yes or no.
Right. Great. Well, thanks. That was a great discussion. I appreciate that we look into it pretty closely. So,
I have one question. We'll see here. Just the difference in the amount.
Do we have time, Jan? Is the next committee coming in?
No. Can you just describe the difference between the original and the amendment on the tax compliance?
Tax compliance. Chair Hovey, Representative Kenny Gear. The tax compliance amendment, what happens is there already is existing in statute a requirement that any contractor who executes a contract with the state must attest and I'm pretty sure it's under oath. In the contract, they have to attest that they have, in fact, complied with all relevant tax laws. And there's a very large number of those tax laws that are included in existing state contracts. There are contract forms that DAS uses that most other agencies tend to use as well. This amendment, or this particular part of the bill, moves that process up just a little bit in the sense that when you are actually receiving proposals from potential contractors, the contracting agency is able to look at that and make a determination of responsibility. Part of that determination of responsibility, which ordinarily includes things like whether they have the resources to be able to undertake this, the expertise, the licensing, and all that sort of thing necessary to perform the contract, we're adding to that an attestation from the company that they have paid relevant taxes. And that's in this particular case for IT projects. It's for all projects.
How does the amendment differ from the original bill? Because both required a tax compliance that wasn't there before.
Chair Holby, Representative Kenny Gare. The amendment actually ratchets back the amount of tax compliance that they are required to report. Before, in the original bill, it was basically the entire panoply of potential taxes that might be out here. In this particular case, we are cutting it back to ones that are most likely to be taxes that for which these contractors would be liable: corporate taxes, personal income taxes if they're sole proprietors,
and things of that nature. So it's a little bit smaller, and it, at that point it means that if there's going to be any kind of auditing or any kind of look at this, that they don't, the contracting agency isn't tasked with the ability of, or the requirement to look into this for every nook and cranny for that kind of compliance, because many of those taxes simply won't apply.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate you taking your time, and I hope you get back to work soon and you're able to make it to work tomorrow as well.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the time that you put into this. So with that, no one else has signed up. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4122 and open a public hearing on House Bill 4132.
Heaven's sake. If I just move, you just get over the floor.
We don't have enough people to vote it out.
Who's watching?
I'm sure somebody is. Jan, would you give us a little preview of House Bill 4132, please?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the bill prohibits a person from sending an advertisement for mortgage loan services or other extensions of credit that's secured by real property if the advertisement has certain characteristics, unless that person had a previous business relationship with the recipient or unless the advertisement meets certain criteria. And it provides that a violation is an unlawful trade practice under 646-608.
Well, welcome to the committee, Representative. If you identify yourself for the record, please.
Certainly. My name is John Lively. I'm a state representative from District 12, which is in Springfield. And I appreciate this opportunity. I've been practicing for 2 weeks, so I hope I don't screw it up. No guarantee so. I'm here today to urge your support of House Bill 4132 relating to regulating certain deceptive advertising practices. This bill, from my standpoint, is a continuation of efforts we started in the 2013 session when we took action to restrict the use of logos and letterhead of some government entities that had contracted with others to provide services on their behalf. Then, the intent then, as it is now, is not to prevent anybody from conducting legitimate business, but to just ensure the public understands who is making the contact and what they are asking or are providing. Today, homeowners face a deluge of mailed advertisements for financial services, especially for mortgage adjustments. Many of these are straightforward advertisements, but some choose to mask their source or attempt to make it seem like they are coming from the homeowner's existing mortgage servicer or even from a government entity. This is dangerous as it might cause the homeowners to miss genuine notices. I think we all get those. In many cases, I know what I do with them. Or become involved with a process which is not what they expected and lead to a decision which is not in their best interest. Some examples I've seen, and I have a couple here with me, but some that I've seen, and I'm sure others have too, is I receive mail and what it says on the outside, action needed now on your mortgage. That's what it says. The return address in many cases is a post office box somewhere, who knows where, but what you read first is action needed now on your mortgage. Or it might say time is running out to adjust your mortgage. Or even your mortgage is at risk. So there's all kinds of information that may appear on the outside of the envelope without it being clear even who it is coming from that might, depending on the position that the person is in that is receiving this information, might compel them to take further action or at least to spend more time on it. All of these might be legitimate offers or concerns if they were coming from your current mortgage provider or even if they identified who the company was or the person contacting you. In addition, it is also important that those receiving these notices understand the fact that this is really an advertisement suggesting to move your mortgage or to modify it with another institution. So they're really advertisements. If you're struggling with your mortgage, these advertised offers may be just enough for you to move in a direction that ultimately does not help. This bill is not about the majority of standard mortgage providers who have every right to advertise, but do it in a manner where you know up front who is contacting you and the fact that this is an advertisement, not something requiring immediate action to address some current mortgage issue. My mortgage provider contacts me often with new information and offers, but each time their name and address is on the outside, and so I know who it's coming from, and it's clear when I open it that it's an offer for some other services than that and not necessarily directing to my current mortgage. The bill will add several restrictions to the existing deceptive advertising rules and or Oregon's unfair trade practices that prevent these types of advertising. This bill will not affect those advertisers who do not try to mask or otherwise deceive those receiving the advertisement. Advertisers will still be able to market products and service to potential customers, but customers will be confident in the identity and the source of the advertisements. Businesses that need to mask their identity in order to advertise are not ones we want doing business in the state of Oregon. Thank you for your consideration of this bill, for this time to testify on this late afternoon.
You bet. Does anyone have questions for Representative Lively on this? I was curious why you chose the Unlawful Trade Practices Act.
Well, I chose the unlawful, the trade...
For a violation of this.
I think it's mostly from the standpoint of being able to enforce. In a case of the state of Oregon, the enforcement then is handled through the Attorney General's office. And so even though the complaints come from a lot of different directions, that allows, from what I understand of the law, it allows the ability... I guess more direct enforcement versus some of the other mechanisms that are available.
Okay.
Just a real quick question.
Sure.
Is it just, I'll call it snail mail, or does this also apply to emails?
Everything.
I think it applies to everything, if I remember. I can look, but it does. It talks about all mechanisms are to deliver the solicitations or the advertisements. That's correct.
Yeah, can you see that, Jan? Go ahead.
I do. Communicate means to send or transmit a message to a recipient through a medium that includes, but it's not limited to, direct mail, electronic mail, or other electronic communication via the Internet.
Correct.
Thank you. So no other questions at this point. We have Michael Savalgio also. Who would like to testify? You can either stay down there or come back.
No, I'll stay down here. Thank you.
Great.
I like the view from
here. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer. And I'll, since I'm almost sure the Treasurer is not actually watching this, I'll just skip through the testimony pretty quickly so we can all beat the traffic. So often the state treasury focuses on broad state-level policy, but part and parcel to that is often the maintenance of personal financial security. And for that reason, I'm pleased to convey the state treasurer's support of House Bill 4132 in helping protect Oregonians from deceptive and misleading advertisements for financial products. We believe it's important for the financial industry to be able to communicate with customers and potential customers, and it's equally important that Oregonians are able to be informed of their financial options. But a business plan that involves concealment, deception, misleading references, or capricious instructions is not, we feel, a business plan that reflects Oregon's values. This bill, for the record, is endorsed by people who like to wear hats, like Pope Francis. And actually, it's not. And although that previous sentence is technically correct, since it's intentionally a misrepresentation, I am required by law to retract it, and I hereby do, because the Legislative Assembly is protected against misleading statements of endorsement when it comes to legislation.
Is he getting paid by the word?
So let me go over a few examples very briefly of why Oregonians deserve the same type of protection enjoyed by the Legislative Assembly. I've got a few ads here that are examples of, and I'll have these entered into record, examples of what I consider legitimate advertisements. This is from Freedom Mortgage, and I need to point out with specific language that examples used carry no endorsement or warranty of the state treasurer whatsoever. This is clearly from Freedom Mortgage. They're clearly trying to sell me a product, and they have listed exactly what they think that can do for me, and that's quite all right. On the other hand, we have this envelope here from something called Administrative Office. This conceals the purpose or identity of the communicator so that people would be misled to the identity or purpose, and it would be so prohibited by the legislation. I'll point out that the zip code here is from Georgia. We could find no registered business under the name Administrative Office in their business records. We have an envelope that says do not discard. That would be prohibited by the legislation as it instructs prohibits instructions to keep a particular advertisement. I'll just skip ahead to my favorite two here. This refers to the Federal Housing Authority, which I do have a pre-existing relationship with, in large text, but then it's tiny text that points out that it's an advertisement actually from American Financial Network. This causes me to open it. And then finally I have this gem. This says principal reduction notice, your J.P. Morgan bank loan, which is indeed the bank I do business with. You open it up and it is an ad, but the insidiousness of this is not that there's an ad inside and I was tricked into looking at it. It's that I was actually compiling these for several months, and at the end of that, when I was going through my pile, I actually encountered two notices from my actual bank, one of them containing my Form 1098 that I need to file my taxes, that had gone entirely unnoticed by me, and I like to think that I'm a sharp guy when it comes to financial stuff, but just because I had become so numb to seeing J.P. Morgan Chase Bank printed on advertisements, it went entirely unnoticed. So in elementary school, we all learned how to address envelopes, and we all learned that you're not supposed to impersonate others on an envelope, and I think that that's not a bad idea to carry forward in legislation. Companies who are willing to apply these tactics in their pitch ought not to have a leg up on financial service providers who are willing to stand on the strength of their product. Aggressive advertising is part of a free and vibrant economy, but ads based on concealment and deception don't present options. They just make personal financial management more precarious and less trustworthy. 4132, we believe, will help add clarity and accountability to these options, and it has the State Treasury's support. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate the testimony. I got a question, because it occurs to me that this practice is already illegal. Are you aware if it's illegal and potentially how many complaints we have on this particular issue?
For the record, this is a subject I think better gone over by an attorney, and I'll state that I'm not an attorney, nor am I an expert on DCBS rules. However, it is referenced in Division 870 of their administrative rules, and I'll point out that there are a few differences, one being that the bill in front of you applies notification requirements to the outside of envelopes as well as the aggregate contents. So whereas you could have an envelope currently that says, read your bank loan, and then open it up and it says, actually, it's about this advertisement, the bill would require that previous to the mention of your bank, they actually have to put on the envelope their own address. In addition to those kinds of slight adjustments, it's my understanding from the discussions that I've had that the DCBS rules are complaint-driven, and that this would enable the Attorney General to work in concert with DCBS to pursue these kind of violations.
Representative Kinnegar.
Is the fee high enough in order to really effectively enforce this?
I'll just point out that that's a policy decision that the legislature needs to make, and we have no position on the fee.
In terms of operationally what it would take to get through the system to actually find these people, prosecute them, whatever. You know, I hope it's a self-sustaining fee. We would make it a self-sustaining and that we'd actually not just morally come out against it, but...
To be clear, the State Treasury is not involved in this kind of enforcement, so I can't answer that with any authority.
Okay. Any other questions? Seeing no questions. I thank you for bringing the bill forward. I know it's an issue that I've dealt with before, and we'll have some more discussions on it later. We're not going to move this bill today, nor any others. And Jan, have we got anything left on our agenda?
for today.
Did you want to mention, just for the record again, carrying over 4140?
Yes, we will be carrying over all of the bills that are on our agenda today, House Bill 4122, House Bill 4135, House Bill 4132, and House Bill 4140. And technically, are we may not be... Well, we'll be scheduling. Let me retract that statement. We will be carrying over House Bill 4140. And the other three bills will come up for posting tomorrow, I believe.
For
work sessions.
Correct, mm-hmm. Correct.
So we will carry over House Bill 4140. Sorry, I misspoke there. With that, any other business? Seeing none, thank you very much, committee, for braving the weather and being here for us today to have this public hearing. With that, I closed the public hearing already for House Bill 4132, and I adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency.